This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Next, I want to really dive deeper on what we've been seeing with the David case, because things have gotten really interesting because Hulu just put out a new doc, so to kind of catch everyone up, a status conference just wrapped up in the D4VD case as David, the singer charged with first-degree murder in special circumstances in the death of 14-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez. While the courtroom moves slowly, social media is on fire, and Hulu just dropped a documentary that dives into the alleged relationship. I just finished watching it last night. It was kind of everything we knew, but a little more shocking because they actually had investigators really spilling their guts on it and, to me, showing some real bias on it. But we'll dive into that in a second. Anyway, Eric Faddis joins us, breaks down what actually happened at the latest hearing, how pretrial publicity and the doc could really affect jury selection, and whether the defense team can use any of this to their advantage. So starting with that background, Eric, the status conference just happened. These hearings are usually about discovery and scheduling. What key fights, again, if you had a chance to catch up on it, I understand if not, we can just talk about everything else around on Crazy David. What key fights are you thinking are likely playing out behind the scenes right now?
Well, gosh, Robin, there's a lot more ammunition on the defense side now with social media than there was before. And what I mean is that, let's say it's a case 1975, and you know, you have publicization of cases then. You got newspapers, you got TV, and that might affect some potential jurors. But here, now that we have social media, you know, if I was defense, I would be hiring a digital forensic expert to do a broad assessment. How many impressions have stories negative to my client got? And how many of those impressions can we tell are reasonably located within California where they want to bring this trial? Millions, probably tens of millions at this point, I'd imagine. And does that give the court concern about whether a juror can be fair and impartial? You know, you can ask the specific jurors, hey, did you personally hear about this? But just in terms of this broad swath of publicity around cases, negative publicity, prejudicial to the defendant, I think it's going to be a huge fight in terms of, can we really have a fair trial in California? Or do we have to move this to some, you know, small jurisdiction where David might even have a better shot?
You know, it was really shocking to me because I looked up who was actually on this doc and how they portrayed the information. So it was Scott Williams, was LAPD. He's a detective investigator involved in the case. He was interviewed on the doc. And then Nathan Hochman, also LA's district attorney, also appears discussing the charges and evidence. And typically when I've seen cases like this where there's been we're just talking about Huerman, you know, and so we saw some people testifying on that, and we saw the, you know, the fake therapist doing things like that. But what really struck me was, again, the verbal leakage I saw was very, very damning, I thought, for David. Granted, I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming, but again, there's no open and shut cases, you know, as you very well know more than anyone else as a defense attorney. But I would think that that would impeach them, although when I did a research on it, maybe not. So, I mean, what compels someone to do that? And how's a judge handle that when you have two people that are going to be testifying? Seemingly, again, context is everything. From my context, had a definite bias when presenting information for public consumption like that.
Yeah, you know, a couple issues come up with that. Certainly, it's fodder for cross-examination once we get there. You know, oh, Mr. Detective, you were asked to be in this Netflix documentary, and you were really giddy about that, right? You know, millions of people would see your face, and your work would be validated, and so you wanted to present it in a really compelling fashion, didn't you? You know, I think there are just ways to show that these folks allegedly could have a personal interest in what's happening, and you know, could that cause a person to have a motivation to fabricate, to exaggerate, to put things in a certain way that's prejudicial to the defense because it looks cool for them in the Netflix series. On top of that, you know, prosecutors cannot make extrajudicial statements about a case that are prejudicial to a defendant generally. And usually that ethical rule applies to people in the prosecutor's employ or who are working under the prosecutor in that case. And so does the prosecutor have some duty to curtail their investigative team's public statements about a case that might be prejudicial to a defendant. I think they might. And I think that that could be an issue as well going forward.
So it's interesting. Go ahead, Todd. You had something first?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, there's a lot of people around David during this time. He's got a large entourage. And for the most part, it seemed like most of them were very, very loyal. We did know that Neil Langston ended up in the grand jury trial or the grand jury and seemed to have turned on David. My question, Eric, is we've got this going on with David right now, but there may be some other people involved. When do you think, and this case, by the way, really stayed under covers. We didn't hear a lot about it until it was finally charged and all that kind of stuff. And all of us on the outside were going, what's going on with this thing? We'd like more details. Is it possible that there could be other charges coming for some of the people around David? And if so, is that going to wait until this goes to trial and maybe David gets convicted and then more charges come out? Or could they come out at the same time over the next several months?
Yeah, a keen insight there because, you know, you typically don't buy two chainsaws for one person to wield in both hands. Usually, if there are two chainsaws, there are two people wielding them. And yeah, I just think that there are a number of circumstances like that in the allegations that suggest that, that David didn't do this by himself. And so in terms of the sequencing and timing of that, Todd, that would typically happen before David's trial. In fact, they would want to charge those folks and then either offer them immunity or some kind of plea deal to testify against David to strengthen their case against whom they believe is the head honcho in all of these horrible alleged circumstances. And so I would expect that to come out before David's trial as opposed to after, but you got to have the goods. And, you know, they waited a while to charge David in this case. Perhaps they are just being overly diligent, overly thorough. Perhaps there is some other reason for the delay. Hard to say, but not surprised there's been a delay.
How far down the ladder could this go? I mean, if somebody was actually involved with the murder or the disappearance of Celeste, that's one thing. But how far down the chain could charges come? People know about it. People were suspecting it. What are those levels?
Sure. So simply suspecting a person of a crime without more it would not result in you being charged with a crime. But there are charges for accessory after the fact, for concealment, for obstruction of an investigation, obstruction of justice. And so, for example, if a person had reason to believe that David did this and the cops came to him and was asking him questions and that individual like tried to throw the cops off of the trail or gave false information, attempting to influence a public servant, there are a panoply of different potential criminal charges that could be levied depending on what the alleged conduct is. But I would be shocked if there was not at least one more culpable actor in this entire saga, just based on, you know, dragging a human being's body to a place where it is going to be disarticulated. And then, you know, I just don't think one person alone did all this.
Yeah. And part of that too, Eric, you know, we have the murder charges, obviously, but and it's documented, and this is what the Hulu doc covered too. You know, it's very well through text messaging and other forensic evidence they got. They started their sexual relationship when she's a minor at 13 years old is when it started, and she's traveling with him, part of the entourage. I know we've covered before on shows, but how does someone not be culpable or becomes culpable of that knowledge that makes them an accessory or not an accessory?
Yeah, so. Very fair question, because, you know, if you see your buddy and he's this superstar and he's hanging out with a 13-year-old girl and he's an adult, anybody would have their eyebrows raised there and say, what's going on here, man? Simply possessing that suspicion is probably not enough. However, if you then aid in some kind of material way, if you, you know, for example, if you see that Celeste's parents calling and you hang up the phone or you know, you see him calling David's phone and you click, you know, terminate that call or whatever, something like that could be enough to, to suggest that the person had knowledge that some criminal activity was going on and aided or tried to conceal it rather than some other action. That's where you get into potentially murky territory criminal.
Yeah, I can see murky territory definitely because of his digital footprint, because he's so connected digitally, and because, and this kind of morphs into my question about this prejudicial, you know, optic that the judge will have or not have. It's like, how do you rule on that when you have on the dock? Again, they didn't say whether they thought he was guilty or innocent, but they very clearly said that David had on his cell phone the proof that they had the underage, you know, relationship, and he had, they said he had child porn on his cell phone when they found it. And so when you present, you know, that a position of authority with that knowledge without a defense attorney arguing against what it could be, doesn't that become prejudicial or not?
Oh gosh, well, sure. And yeah, I think the information allegedly on his phone is so damning. You know, everyone before that came out, everyone was like, what in the world is this adult doing with this like 13-year-old girl? That seems pretty suspicious. What's going on? And then I think the revelation of the alleged evidence found on his cell phone cleared that up for a lot of folks in terms of what David was interested in. And you know, and that's assuming that this evidence is what the government says it is. I haven't seen it personally, so I can't say.
Right. But, and I'm sorry, Eric, that's the key, is that you keep saying that beautiful word modifier, allegedly. On the dock, they didn't use that word. And that's why I found it. I mean, so you give, you know, the world of maybe out there, which can, that which, so you allow people to do their jobs, but this show did not give a maybe in there whatsoever.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that is, you know, I think during jury selection, they're going to be asking all these folks, hey, have you seen this documentary? You'd agree that in the documentary, they affirmatively, conclusively state basically that David is a pedophile. And you realize that this alleged victim is 13 years old and he was an adult, right? And does that give you some concerns about being a juror in this case and things like that? And I think that it gives the defense a lot of grounds to kick jurors who have seen that, who have seen that documentary. And it's going to make it a lot harder for the judge to determine, is this the appropriate venue in which to have this? Or do we need to go to some Amish community or something? And I'm talking kind of facetiously, but a lot of exposure in terms of this.
Be an interesting jury. I got a question for you, Robin. Watching that documentary, when you listen to the people who spoke with and were around David when he was younger, a lot of good things said about him. Kind, yeah. Very, very polite, and also God following. Yeah. Were you surprised at that? And then also, do you feel like that was it all just a front, or was there some evolution from David back in Texas to what he became when he was in Los Angeles?
It's a great question, Todd, because when I was watching that doc, I was actually kind of surprised at what I saw, because to your observation, he looked pretty well adjusted. He was saying all the right things. And, but we had a wobble there. You know, I do these behavior tells in this wobble. The wobble was the lyrics of his song, which I know a lot of people and artists will do different things, say different things, and create their art in different ways. So that was like, to me, I focused on that. Wow, that's an interesting wobble about how his lyrics are so dark. So to me, I saw the potential of that undercurrent, but had I not known about what he wound up accused of doing, because we're still using that world of not innocent until convicted or proven guilty, I was kind of surprised but again, you got editing, you have Hulu. So there was, to me, watching that doc, there's missing pieces of that life that he was portraying if it plays out the way it was. Because he seemed like a pretty normal, well-adjusted, healthy individual until things weren't. So I'm really curious.
I mean, there were people in the documentary, the interviewers, who were like, he was so cool that afterward I took a selfie with him.
Yeah.
I mean, that was almost verbatim.
The newscaster, yeah.
Yeah. I've got a question for Eric. We got the preliminary hearing coming up on the 21st, right? What does that look like for the judge that day? What does it look like for the prosecution? And David's defense. Is there any possible way the judge says there's nothing, there's not enough here to take this to trial?
I think there is a possibility of that, Todd, and that's really the exception rather than the rule. And here's why. So preliminary hearings are an opportunity for the judge to determine, is there enough evidence to bump this case over to the trial phase? That threshold of enough evidence is just probable cause. That's just, are there reasonable grounds to believe that he committed this crime? But in this case, there are some questions as to where the crime was committed, who was there, who was wielding the death instrument, how did this happen? Can we rule out an accident? Can we rule out, you know, an overdose, things like that? I think that those questions are still in play. Certainly the government has answers that they believe are true, but I'm sure that we're at a conclusive point on some of those questions. Now, I think the judge is likely to bind the case over for trial, but I think this one, there's at least a little better chance for the defense that they might win at the preliminary hearing. And even if they don't win, you still get benefits of a preview of the prosecution's case. What's it going to look like? What do they think's important? How do their witnesses testify? What weaknesses might those witnesses have? These are all tidbits you get on the defense side from the preliminary hearing, even if you lose, which 99% of the time you lose.
And we haven't really heard much pushback at all from David's defense team yet on this. Are you surprised by that, or do you think they're waiting? What do you think the strategy is?
Yeah, I think it makes sense for the defense on this one especially to wait and see what the government has, because the allegations are so inflammatory. Anybody who hears them, you know, it's not only is it murder of a child, but it's also SA of a child. Anyone who just hears the charges are like, oh, like that's horrible. But do they really have the beef to back it up? Can they really substantiate the elements of this murder happened on this date? It happened this way. We can put the death instrument in David's hands or something, or do they not have that? And we'll learn at the preliminary hearing more about what they have. So if I was defense, I would be playing things close to the vest, and I would be looking to counterpunch, and I would be saying, hey, let's see where these holes might be. And then once we identify them, we can try to open those up.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what holes they try to poke at, from the guy who bought online two chainsaws, a pool, a burn box, and bags, body bags for lawn waste, I guess. Eric, fascinating conversation. There's a lot more to come on this case. Make sure you hit like and follow wherever you get your podcast. That's going to be a wrap for today, folks. Check out Hidden Killers Live tomorrow at 11 Central, when we'll be joined by retired FBI agent Jennifer Coffendeffer. Until then, for Eric, for Todd, for Tony, who is on vacation, still on his honeymoon, I'm Robin Dreek with Hidden Killers Live. Back again real soon. Have a great day.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.